enough for Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today, you're going to meet a man who is a little more modest than this, but he is identified as the father of green chemistry. John C. Warner, co-founder of the Warner Babcock Institute, will be talking with us in just a moment. He'll tell us what green science is all about. And while he is not in pursuit of perfection, he acknowledges that green science can improve the work we do today and reduce toxicity. I think you'll find it very interesting. I certainly did. And I want to recommend this to our listeners in New England, because you're invited to visit the Warner Babcock Institute and its companion organization, Beyond Benign, in suburban Boston. And with that in mind, I want to acknowledge the support of Stuart Smith, Del Leonard, and many other listeners in New England who are subscribers to the Peter B. Collins podcast. And I'd like you I want to invite you to join their ranks. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on the link that says sign up right under my picture on the homepage, and you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month. Our best deal is the $50 annual subscription. And new subscribers anywhere within the sound of my voice, yes, that includes outside the United States, qualify for our current bonus gift, which is an ebook copy of Pepe Escobar's exciting new volume called Empire of Chaos. I hope you'll sign up. I'd love to send you a copy. And thanks for joining us today here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. And today we're going to head into the lab and talk about green chemistry on the Peter B. Collins Podcast. It's not really Halloween, but this is the only lab song I could think of.
My eyes beheld an eerie sight, for my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
Dr. John C. Warner joins us at the secret studio today. Is that on your iPod, sir? The Monster Mash?
In fact, it is.
Is it really?
Yes, it is.
Are there any other cool lab songs? As I said, it's the only one I could think of.
No, not really. Yeah.
Nothing about microscopes or test tubes?
Yeah, but you wouldn't want to hear them.
Magic formulas. What's green chemistry?
Green chemistry is making molecules that have minimum impact on human health and the environment.
Mm-hmm.
The reality, you know, so I have a PhD in chemistry.
From Princeton.
Was patted on the top of the head, given a document, and said, go out and work in industry and invent the future, like many other chemists. I never had a class in toxicology. I never had a class in environmental mechanisms. If you Google any university and look at their chemistry department, imagine that you're a student that wants to get a degree in chemistry, you will never find a university that requires you to take a class in toxicology and environmental impacts. Mm-hmm. If you think about that, kind of a strand. You know, we know that there are red dyes that cause cancer. We know that there are plasticizers that cause birth defects. We know that there are these things out there. You know, you got to ask yourself, why would a chemist make a molecule that's toxic, that's hazardous?
Mm-hmm.
Well, wait a minute. If chemists aren't taught toxicity, environmental impact, how could they not make a molecule toxic? So green chemistry is the band-aid. It's the repair mechanism. It's the missing element in chemistry to essentially create whole chemists that now actually understand from a scientific mechanistic perspective, how do you design molecules that are less toxic and less impactful into the environment?
And so it's really opening up the full spectrum, because what you explained was that you saw part of the spectrum, which is how to use chemicals for specific purposes, but they didn't teach you about the negative consequences and the long-term impacts of many of these processes and compounds.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought experiment. If you were to hold up to a chemist a jar of some material and say, what are the chemical physical properties of this material? They're going to think, oh, it's a solid, a liquid, a gas. It's got a melting point of this. It's got a boiling point of that. We remember our high school chemistry. Maybe it gets more tricky. It's got a conductivity of this. It's, you know, you can think of all these things. It is highly unlikely that that chemist would say it's not toxic. It's has this impact on the environment. For some weird reason, the field of chemistry has evolved that toxicity and environmental impact isn't a chemical property. It's something else.
Is it kind of Enron accounting, you know, where you hide the losses offshore?
No, this is not an epic battle of good and evil. This is just some weird evolution that for whatever reason it didn't occur to chemists that they could mechanistically look at that. You know, if I'm asked, you know, I want a red dye to coat this coffee mug, and so we want it to be a certain color. We want it to stick to the mug. Obviously, we don't want it to wash off. We don't want it to fade in the light. We don't want it to oxidize. I, as a chemist, can, okay, you want this, you want this, and then look at the molecular structure, superimpose it on the classes that I've had in the past, and say, okay, this is how I'm going to make it red. This is how I'm going to make it stick. This is how I'm going to make it stable, all that. But then you come and say, but John, it's a carcinogen. I'm dead stop. I can't go to a class that I had in my past that taught me what makes molecules carcinogens. So how can I design a molecule that's not a carcinogen if I haven't had those classes? And so if we add to the curriculum of chemistry, not infinite, I mean, we can't solve all these problems. We don't know all the mechanisms, but just start to integrate a little bit of that knowledge to the people who in the future will be designing molecules. That's the path. So that's the vision of green chemistry, is to just look at this as an intellectual pursuit, figure out the mechanisms of harm at the molecular level, and then we design future products, make sure that we address those mechanisms and don't do it.
Now, is it also a consequence of our market economic system and the pressure to produce profits this quarter? Because I don't believe that the people who installed asbestos as an insulation element in buildings, you know, for decades, wanted to hurt people, but they were simply looking at the fastest way to profit and not considering the long-term impacts.
Absolutely. That's part of it. I do not subscribe to the epic battle of good and evil that people are, you know, using toxic hazardous materials intentionally for the most part. And I'm sure there are exceptions, but for the most part, I don't believe that. I believe that there are other, this rush to market, this impatience of investment and things like that. But think of it this way. Right now in 2014, I would argue that if you have a material that has superior performance, that has superior cost, and is less toxic and better for the environment, who wouldn't want it? Who wouldn't want to sell it? Who wouldn't want to manufacture it? So in my opinion, the biggest hurdle is the invention in the first place. There aren't market barriers. There's no other than if you build a better mousetrap, people beat a path to the door. But if the skill set of how to invent such a thing doesn't exist in most chemists' hands, we're stuck with what we've got. And so that's the problem. And the thing is, you're absolutely right. We need patient investment that's realized that this isn't the fastest thing to invent. This is adding. You know, I just talked about making the red dye that doesn't. We can spend years trying to invent the red dye that sticks to the coffee mug and doesn't fade into all that. If you're adding to that, oh, and by the way, we don't want it to be toxic or have impact on the environment, we've just delayed that invention even more. And mm-hmm. so if we are motivated to have the quick turn of the return on investment, we're not patient to do that appropriately, that is one of the biggest barriers. Even though everyone acknowledges it would be better, we're not looking at making money in 5 years. We're looking at money next quarter. Mm-hmm. That does inhibit this.
Mark Shapiro, the environmental journalist, was here recently, and his new book about climate change, he focuses on the true cost mm-hmm. of human activity. And, for example, U.S. airlines are not required to even collect data on how much carbon they burn and the way they deliver it to the atmosphere, because they're already up there in the jet mm-hmm. airliners. And that's just one example mm-hmm. of how we don't recognize, reflect, or pay the full price mm-hmm. For the energy and other elements that we use.
Absolutely. And what's interesting is we don't really address that in other ways, too. Companies, every company that's in business today, it is highly unlikely they're operating in the most efficient way. They're missing things all over the place. But the training of the scientists and the employees to address some of those missing things are high. But when it comes to environment and toxicity, because of the lack of training, but think of the cost. You know, to dispose of a hazardous material costs more than to dispose of a safe material. To store a hazardous material costs more. The liability, the litigation, all of the associated costs with a hazardous material, a company would kill to have the safer technology because of just fundamental. It's less lawyer bills, less everything else. But if they in their heart don't believe they have the skill set to invent it in the first place, what do they do?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the importance of green chemistry, is until we have a workforce and a science that can start addressing these things, this isn't that people don't want it. They honestly don't believe they can do it.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Dr. John Warner here on the Peter B. Collins podcast. You worked at the Polaroid Corporation for a number of years, and I wanted to ask you about that because as a kid, my dad had a Land camera, Polaroid mm-hmm. Land camera. It was Dr. Land, who mm-hmm. was the inventor of instant developing film. Mm-hmm. And I was always fascinated by that. I love to take pictures. And, you know, now we're all spoiled with mm-hmm. digital photography. But this was the picture that you could take and not have to send that roll of film to,
yes.
you know, through the drugstore to a processing lab.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always so exciting, mm-hmm. you know, to see the picture a minute after it was taken.
Mm-hmm.
But I always wondered, as I pulled out one of those, packages, the little slip with the photo embedded in the chemicals, what's in that?
Mm-hmm.
And is it safe?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we used it around kids. You just toss it in the trash. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea. I, as a kid, I had a photo lab, you know, with the Hyper Fixer and all those mm-hmm. chemicals. But I never knew what was in the Polaroid secret sauce.
Mm-hmm.
What was it, can you say, now that the company no longer makes the film? Somebody does, right? Is there an aftermarket?
There probably is. But I suspect that in a complete analysis, there's probably a lot of environmental benefit to what Polaroid used to do. You know, I don't work for them. I'm not advocating. Mm-hmm. I'm not on any soapbox here. But if you think about it, all the chemistry was contained in that film. People weren't putting their hands in develop a bath. You didn't have big jars stored around. You know, so mm-hmm. from one perspective, there was a certain benefit. But of course, with that, there's added waste, and nothing is perfect. So I think compared to what we would consider conventional photography, it was no better, it was no worse. There mm-hmm. were trade-offs in one way or another. But the thing about Polaroid is back in the 80s when I worked, it was the coolest place to work as a chemist. That
yeah.
was really, if you're an organic polymer chemist, Polaroid was like one of the most exciting, phenomenal places. Edwin Land was just an amazing inventor,
mm-hmm.
and it was really cool back then.
Give us an yeah. anecdote. What was so mm-hmm. cool about it? What turned you on about working at Polaroid?
Well, that's really interesting because my formal training is in medicinal chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, for my graduate work, was designing anti-cancer drugs, of all things. Mm-hmm. And the senior corporate officer of Polaroid, a guy named Dr. Lloyd Taylor, met me and offered me a job to work in exploratory research at Polar. And my first reaction was, what am I going to do at a place like Polaroid? I'm a medicinal chemist, mm-hmm. God's sakes. But then when I got there, it was really kind of interesting because me being trained as a medicinal chemist and all these physiological pathways and cycles and everything, first thing I did, I just want to know, how does Polaroid work? How does that camera picture work? Mm-hmm. And so I got really into it and talked to all the different scientists and created, you know, back then, you know, there wasn't digital imaging and things like that. So it was a set of overhead slides and 35 millimeter slides that described the Polaroid process from a chemical perspective, and realized that when you push that button on a Polaroid camera, over 150 different chemical reactions are initiated.
Wow.
All different, because if you think about it, the film comes out of the camera.
Yeah.
Why isn't that light exposing? So what happens is one chemical comes in to make an artificial dark room. And so that while the chemistry is happening underneath, it makes it black and then it comes clear and then the picture. Mm-hmm. And so it is just so damn complicated that the elegance of it, that and again, it goes back to the first. I would argue that society will never see another Polaroid because that was a multi-year R&D project. Mm-hmm. Land had this vision, and he, you know, was relentless and worked
and
for years and years. I'm not entirely sure. I know that, you know, Polaroid started in the you know, middle of the 20th century, early 20th century, as a polarized film. Mm-hmm. Manufacturer, hence the name Polaroid, was they started manufacturing polarizers. And so the Polaroid sunglasses,
sure,
and polarized this, that, and the other thing. And I mm-hmm. suspect they had military contracts. And that's so the initial Polaroid company was manufacturing polarized film. And legend has it, and this is legend, and I don't know if it's folklore or not, is that Edward Land, the founder that has this Polaroid film company, is vacationing one day and he takes a traditional photograph of his daughter. And his daughter looks up at him and says, "Daddy, I want to see this picture." And he goes, "No, honey, we have to go home. We have to bring it and develop." And she looks at him and goes, "Daddy, I want to see this picture now." And she goes, "No, honey, you're going to have to go home." And now, having four daughters myself, I suspect he invented instant photography just to shut her up.
And so how did your work at Polaroid, if at all, put you on this path to write a book about green chemistry, form an institute, and this has spread now where the American Chemical Society and the EPA all embrace green chemistry. I want to ask you if they are sincere in that, but you really have spawned a fascinating movement.
So it's interesting. There's a lot of people that are working in green chemistry, and oftentimes, John, one of the fathers, the founders of green chemistry, Paul and I, Paul Anastas and I wrote the book, and Paul was very, very big in the EPA starting the field of green chemistry, but there's been so many people working in the field of green chemistry that, you know, the unsung, I seem to be getting a lot of the attention as a figurehead, but I feel that attention is really just as a spokesperson for a lot of other people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened with me is when I was at Polaroid, you got to ask yourself, what would a medicinal chemist do at a place like Polaroid?
Take pictures of diseases.
And so I started thinking about it, and I was looking at manufacturing in general, very introspective, and saying, you know, when we manufacture things, what do? We heat things at high temperature. We put things under high pressure, and we use all these harsh reagents to make chemistry happen.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Nature, on the other hand, does everything at room temperature, does everything at ambient pressure, and for the most part uses water as a solvent. Now, that's a common theme people want right now. But then I went the next step and said, why? Why is it that nature can be so efficient? And what I realized was when we learn chemistry, we learn that molecules have certain shapes, and when they bang into each other, only certain unique trajectories produce a chemical reaction, and most of those collisions do nothing. They just bounce off. And so we as humans, when we manufacture something, heat things to high temperature and high pressure to increase the velocity of the molecules banging around so that the frequency of those collisions is more, so that statistically what we want to have happen happens more. What I realized as a medicinal chemist is that in nature, there's never such a reaction, a collision.
Mm-hmm.
In nature, molecules first snuggle up to each other. They assemble, orient, then do the chemical reaction. And so
there's foreplay?
I guess you could say that in a certain way. They spoon each other.
Am I to bond? Yeah. Am I going to bond with you?
I suspect there's a little of that, yeah. Molecular promiscuity and whatnot. but the point is that I said, well, what if I look at Polaroid's manufacturing processes and introduce that kind of prior association to do it? And it worked. And I came up with this concept called non-covalent derivatization. I'm not going to kill you on that because it's kind of boring, but I love it. The license plate of my car is NCD for non-covalent derivatization. Trust me, I can go on and on and on about this. But nevertheless, Polaroid went to large-scale manufacturing with this technology that I invented called non-covalent derivatization.
You have a number of patents, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And to do that in the United States, to go to manufacturing, you can't just do it. You got to get EPA approval. And so this is before computers, so there's several bankers' boxes wrapped up and shipped to Washington, D.C., and we waited. And the EPA was hesitant to approve the technology, not because of toxicity, not because of environmental impact. It was just new and different. Mm-hmm. So they didn't know what to do with it. Just, what is this crazy person talking about molecular collisions and all this stuff? And so I had to go to Washington, D.C. and give a seminar and explain this crazy thing called non-covalent derivatization. When I was there, I bumped into my childhood friend that had grown up in the same city, Quincy, Massachusetts, and he and I got you know, really talking about it. Isn't it interesting that anything better for the environment is going to fundamentally be new and different, right? And if the EPA has barriers to doing anything new and different, aren't they by definition working against anything better for the environment? Here is this crazy synthetic chemist who at Polaroid invented something that is fundamentally better for the environment, lower temperature, lower that, and the EPA struggling with giving it approval. Shouldn't we be promoting that? And that's when we realized that the field of science, we love our little disciplines. There's all these different people call themselves biologists, chemists, organic chemists, physical chemists. This is 1989, 1990 time frame. Here is someone saying, how do you design a molecule that is environmentally benign and non-toxic? Do people talk about that? Are there conferences? Are there journals? Are there textbooks? And the fact of the matter is, no. It's just not part of that agenda. And so Paul and I, we wrote this book, Green Chemistry Theory and Practice, to create a science. It's not a policy. It's not a philosophy. It's not a movement. It is the science of how, when a chemist designs a material or a process, what are the mechanistic molecular level strategies that one uses to make it less toxic, environmentally benign. And if we could have journals and textbooks and classes and workshops, then one chemist could come up with one solution, another, and that's how science works, is incrementally building off of one another. That was how the field of green chemistry in that book came about.
And the others who've embraced it, I just mm-hmm. did a Google search, and what did I come up with here? The 12 Principles of Green Chemistry, some attributed to you at the American Chemical Society. Is their embrace of green chemistry consistent with your view?
Yes.
Or is this greenwashing?
So the 12 Principles of Green Chemistry, in my opinion, are what's makes green chemistry a science and not something. If you read the 12 principles, so Paul and I crafted the 12 principles in our book back mm-hmm. in the mid-90s, and they don't sound like slogans and bumper stickers. You know, they sound like chemistry. You know, they're talking about reaction coordination. And, you know, it's a mm-hmm. you read this thing and it's and that's, I think, the thing to understand is that green chemistry is not an evaluative process to sell a technology. It is a research and development tool to make a better product. And so,
well, it's more of a set of protocols.
Well,
the
way to think of it is there are many programs out there that evaluate the sustainability of a technology, you know, cradle to cradle, green screen. There are many things out there that companies can do to say, look, we've certified because of this. I look at it as a golfer. You know, I'm not a golfer. My wife is an awesome golfer. I'm laughable, but I watched her play, so I got a general idea of this thing. Imagine if you had a bunch of golfers and you wanted to evaluate their game. So you said, okay, everybody, drive with your driver, and you measure how far they drive and how straight they drive.
That's my weakest part.
Okay, yeah. I usually, but I swing more times than most people, so I'm getting more for my money on the golf course, so I'm okay with that. But then you line them up and you say, okay, get out of a sand trap. Okay, let's look at this short game. Let's look at this. And you could create an Excel spreadsheet that records everybody's statistics and say, on any given day, on any given course, this person will come in first, this person will come in second, this person will come in third, right? So knowing that information, what if you want to get better? What if you say, how can we get person A to improve? Does knowing that statistics, although it's important to know it, does it do anything to improve? And I would argue no. How do you improve? Well, that is the intangible things that don't fit well on a spreadsheet. How do they square their shoulders? How do they hold the club? How do they put their... That's where green chemistry mm-hmm. comes in. It's not the noun of what does the product do. It is the verb of how do you improve it. Mm-hmm. And if chemists haven't had classes in toxicology and environmental mechanisms, how can they improve a technology and make it less toxic? So the 12 principles of green chemistry is that guide to help push the ball down the field.
Mm-hmm. All right. I also found the EPA's page mm-hmm. about green chemistry, and they have Presidential Green Chemistry Challenge.
Yes.
So they're trying to work on the education pipeline to advance the adoption of green chemistry?
Not really. What they're doing is great. So back when Paul Anastas was at the EPA, back in the early 90s, he and I and a group of people produced what's now called the Presidential Green Chemistry Challenge Award. And what that is, it's an award given by the U.S. EPA and the President of the United States. So it is a U.S.-centric program, but that's where we are. And what it said was to companies, to nominate a technology that it is consistent with the 12 principles of green chemistry that you've developed. And so usually there are hundreds of nominees, and every year 5 awards are given. And so if you were to Google that search and find it, you'll now find it's been going on for nearly 20 years. It survived. It was formed in the Clinton administration, transitioned to the Bush administration, transitioned to the Obama administration. The fact that it's still around is kind of a cool thing in itself. But
what's the half-life of green chemistry?
So far, so good. But the thing is now that becomes a textbook of green chemistry, because you can go in and look now at 120 case studies that say, okay, company XYZ has this product and it was doing this, and so they invented a way to make it better in one way or another. And so that program is phenomenal, because it is the one of the major information disseminations. Now 20 years later, there are journals, there are textbooks, there are classes, there are conferences, and so green chemistry has become somewhat mainstream in industry. Now, here's the interesting thing that might surprise you. Industry has embraced green chemistry. Academia is a little bit slower in adopting it.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, who knows? I have my theories. My theory is that the metric of success in academia is publishing a paper. The metric of success in industry is making a product. Mm-hmm. Now, you can publish a lot of papers and never make a product. You can publish a lot of papers that no one's ever going to read, and so do you really need to worry about it being toxic? And so if anything, that's going to slow you down to publish your papers. And so, and if no one has ever had these classes, who's going to teach it?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of a difficult conundrum of how do you get into it. But in industry, if you think about it, someone comes out of a university, goes to work at a place like Polaroid, invents a technology. Everyone gets excited. They go, oh, my God, this is great. This is going to be the next thing. And we got everyone. And a half a year later, someone goes, well, wait a minute. You're using what solvent? You're using what reagent? The EPA regulations won't let us do that. We have to build this. It's going to be so expensive. And so they have to invent it a second time to be compliant with the real world of manufacturing. Mm-hmm. So industry says, wouldn't it have been better if that chemist who invented it in the first place had a clue about the real world? So they see green chemistry as real world chemistry. What is it that's going to be to make it less expensive and more cost effective?
So then why isn't there a Dow chair of green chemistry at Princeton?
Not at Princeton, but Dow supports quite a lot of work at UC Berkeley. There's a huge green chemistry program at UC Berkeley. Dow has internal green chemistry programs. every major chemical company that I'm aware of has internal programs. They're scratching their head saying, man, we wish that the universities were teaching this. But companies are taking that burden onto themselves. And it's not out of altruism. Obviously, if you're faster to market, if you're not paying the disposal and the regulatory and the liability costs, you're going to be more cost effective. There is a growing awareness in consumers. They want these savings. So it's kind of a no-brainer that making a product that has superior performance, superior cost, and is, oh, by the way, non-toxic, who wouldn't want it?
Yeah.
So they see this as just smart business. And many countries have similar programs. And so there are international green chemistry awards. There's international journals. You know, every country that I'm aware of has different aspects of green chemistry going on.
So let me ask you this. Here in the Bay Area, Clorox is based, one of the biggest multinational purveyors of chlorine as a household cleaning agent. And there was a big controversy a couple of years ago when the Sierra Club signed a deal to endorse a green product line made by Clorox. Have you looked at those products, and do they live up to the labeling? Are they simply greener than the old school Clorox products, or are they, you know, truly what a consumer would regard as less toxic or non-toxic?
Yeah. Well, I guess A couple of things. The first of all, I'm not in a position to evaluate. I don't know their technology specifically, so I don't know that. But more importantly, I think that we've got to realize, here I'm going to say this very profound statement, there is no such thing as green chemistry. There is only greener chemistry, that everything we do as humans has impact on human health and the environment. There is no such thing as zero. All right. And so all we can do is say that tomorrow we're going to be better than today, and next year we're going to be better than this year. It's kind of like saying, who is healthier? You know, if you line up 10 people, you know, what does it mean to say that someone's healthier? Well, is it weight? Is it cholesterol? So if you have all these different aspects of health, well, there's a certain amount of subjectivity of what you define as health. And so green chemistry is kind of the same thing. If you are passionate about cancer, you've lost a loved one to cancer, then damn it, you want products that are not carcinogenic, and you may not care so much if they're ozone depleters or something like that. And the fact is that if no science, you know, if we're not training scientists to address this, it's going to take a real long time to have things that really hit all the buttons. You know, there's 12 principles, and we say, okay, we want products that are compliant with all 12 of the principles. Well, the way science works is maybe today someone comes up with a way of addressing one of the principles, and somewhere in Italy a chemist comes up with one for another principle, and then somewhere in India someone comes up with another, and then someone comes up with a great idea to put those two together. And we're talking decades of R&D. It took 200 years of chemistry to get to where we are now. We can't snap our fingers and tomorrow everything be green. So in my opinion, we need to celebrate those successes, but we do, not necessarily in a cynical way, but we do have to be careful about greenwashing and baloney, because there is a lot of that. And so if you accept that green chemistry is not a marketing tool, it is an R&D tool, then one thermometer, when someone's using it as a marketing tool, you might want to look at it a little bit differently.
The bullshit detector can go off.
Yeah, yeah, but the problem is... You know, think about it this way. If chemists don't learn about toxicity and environmental impact, if the only people in the world who understand molecular structure and the relationship of molecular structure to how a molecule behaves, and they don't understand toxicity and environmental impact, who's talking about it? So until chemists get actively into this conversation and up the game to start really correlating molecular structure to this, who has the tools to evaluate what's bullshit and what's not? And so that's why it's so important for chemists to start learning this, to up that game.
John, share with our listeners, and take as much time as you need, one or two of the most exciting developments that you see as a product of your work on green chemistry, which does and doesn't exist.
So one example that I'm particularly happy with, so the Wanda Babcock Institute for Green Chemistry is in Wilmington, Massachusetts. We came up with a technology for asphalt paving. Okay. There's a billion miles of road in the United States alone. The worldwide, it's astronomical. Every year, about 10% of those roads are repaved. When we repave a road, we dig up the old asphalt, and because of the sunlight and the air has oxidized that surface, that material can't be reused and is typically put in a landfill. Maybe we can put a little bit back in, but most of it goes to a landfill. Now, that stuff that we've dug out still has asphalt, the petroleum product wrapped around it, but it's just being tossed away, and then we dig up more petroleum, get more rocks and sand, and we pave it back down again. And so we came up with a technology where we add a special non-toxic, environment benign additive to the old asphalt to allow it to be more compatible and to be reused. And so it was really kind of funny. About exactly a year ago in Boston, Mass., where I live, it was 17 degrees Fahrenheit. I wanted to test this technology, so I dug up my driveway. My family was pretty like, what the heck? You know, there's nothing wrong with that driveway. Well, that's okay, it's okay. And we dug up the driveway in two dump trucks with 30 tons of asphalt. And the workers are laughing at me. They're saying, John, it's 17 degrees Fahrenheit. You can't pave in 17 degrees Fahrenheit. And you're using 65% recycled content. We've never used more than 10%. This is ridiculous. We're going to open up the truck and a big hockey puck is going to come and we're driving away and we're going to leave it here. No, that's okay. That's okay. They open it up. It comes out like powdered sand. They scream like school children and jump on their machines and they roll that down. And a year and a week later, it is perfect. I had, you know, it's kind of bold. I had people from government agencies, from regulatory agencies with clipboards watching the process. And so now we've started a company called Collaborative Aggregates. And the product is called Delta S. And hundreds and hundreds of miles of road are already paved and it's being specced in different states as a way of using recycled material at lower temperature to do it. And that's all designed with the principles of green chemistry.
Wow. And so many things come to mind because winter is when roads take the most beating for various reasons. And it's hard for road crews to patch a pothole that appears in the winter because of the temperature and other conditions. Yeah. So right away, I see, you know, the little light bulb goes off for me.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, I interviewed a professor from Stanford who is working in a startup. And forgive me if I bungle some of the chemistry here, but they have come up with a way to synthetically produce Portland cement, which is the active ingredient in ready-mix concrete. And the process is being, it's sited near a power plant, a gas-burning power plant in near Santa Cruz. And they sequester some of the emissions from the power plant, and they mix that together with elements of coral. And they have managed to create at a much cheaper level and without the, apparently the process of creating Portland cement the old-fashioned way is very energy and carbon intensive. And so they've come up with a way that, that uses carbon to convert, I guess, the molecules in the coral or whatever that element is to create this synthetic high-bonding compound. And I don't know the status of it today. I haven't seen it rolled out even as a test product. But that strikes me as just a very interesting use of chemistry to address the negative aspects of the way we've been doing it for decades.
That, you know, I'm not familiar with the specifics of that example, but as you describe it, that sounds like a perfect example of green chemistry.
So where do you see this going, and what is your mission at the Warner Babcock Institute?
Okay. So my dream, my mission, is there's actually two companies in Wilmington. There's the Warner Babcock Institute for Green Chemistry. That is a for-profit beakers and flask research laboratory, 42,000 square feet, 30 chemists pouring beakers and flasks, inventing stuff. It's an invention factory of green chemistry technologies. We've got Alzheimer's drugs, Parkinson's drugs, anti-cancer drugs, asphalt, wood composites, solar energy. It's just a dream come true. It's what I, you know, kind of imagine is what Polaroid would be if it's, you know, because that's where I cut my teeth.
And or so maybe the Bell Labs.
Exactly. Well, that's exactly. So the Bell Labs of sustainability. Mm-hmm. I'd like to think that that's what we are, and we're having a blast. But also there's a nonprofit called Beyond Benign. And Beyond Benign is run by Amy Cannon, full disclosure, my beautiful wife. Mm-hmm. She runs Beyond Benign, and that is looking at curriculum development, not only university, but K through 12, mm-hmm. to say, how can we get this green chemistry type stuff into the curriculum? And she has an important program called the Green Chemistry Commitment. And what she's doing is she's trying to get all the universities in the world, the chair of the chemistry department, to say, well, gee, we acknowledge that no one in this department has ever had these classes, so we don't know who's going to teach it. But we've got to come up with a mechanism to do that. So let's commit to, in the next 5 years, come up with a way to get this so that someday no one graduates from this department not having this training. And she unrolled this about a year ago, maybe a little less, and already about 50 universities have already signed on. UC Berkeley, the largest chemistry program in the United States, mm-hmm. is one of the signers. Now that, I think, is really important. That is what it's all about. And so the inventions that the Wanda Babcock Institute are making give me the credibility to go and say, well, maybe we should be doing this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, at Warner Babcock, I mean, that sounds like a playground for a guy like you. Pure science, open-ended. Mm-hmm. How the hell do you fund it?
Yeah. Well, it's not pure science. So just to be clear, so let's put it in context here. So here I am in 2007, a full professor of chemistry at the University of Massachusetts, plastics engineering in UMass Lowell, chemistry in Boston. Very nice, wonderful job, full tenured professor, a very safe and good job. And I meet Jim Babcock, who's from the Marin area in California. I'm just a brilliant visionary investor. And he and I cook up the idea to come up with the Wanda Babcock Institute. Now think about this. 2007, history's worst economy.
Yeah.
I'm going to jump out of academia and start a for-profit company. But what we felt is that if we played by the rules of industry, we took no government grants, we took no philanthropic money, but we were strictly business to business. And we went to all the big companies, the little companies and the middle-sized companies, or they came to us, and we invented for them these technologies. If we could make a go at that, and we could be successful at that, what better way to tell the world that this is the right thing to do? 18 months later, we were cash positive, and we've got tons of products on the market and going towards the market. And so it is a dream come true Taj Mahal of chemistry research. Okay, it has every instrument that you could possibly dream of having under one roof. But the toys are great, but it's the people that they're the 35 of the best scientists that you can possibly imagine that are just working. We don't publish that many papers and journals. We don't speak at technical conferences. Our entire focus is just inventing products that are cost-effective, that are superior performance, and, oh, by the way, have better environmental and toxicological impacts. And, you know, it's a dream come true.
Wow. Yeah. John, I have a number of listeners in New England. Is there anything available for the public? Can you tour Warner Babcock?
You know, I have to say, you asked me at the very beginning of this podcast, you asked me if I had that song on my iPod. And I laughed because a couple weeks ago, you know, we had an art show. So the Beyond Benign, if you came to the Wanda Babcock Institute in Wilmington, you'd be very confused. You'd think you were in an art gallery, okay? It does not look like a chemistry lab. What I feel, creativity and innovation must happen at the intersection of art and science, that we've separated society, that there's artists over here and scientists over there, but creativity and innovation must acknowledge that. And so Beyond Benign is constantly featuring different artists and showing this. And the latest art exhibit featured monsters. And the whole theme was, interestingly enough, is that here are all these monsters, and they're very lighthearted artist thing. And I invite you to go to the Beyond Benign website and learn about the artist and the work that's going on there. But what, you know, if you think about it.
.org.com?
Yeah, beyondbenign.org.
Okay.
You know, and so...
There's a monster right there on the homepage.
Absolutely, yes. And and the artist featured there. The idea is, if you think about when we were children, we were convinced that there were monsters under the bed, there were monsters in the closet, and we were terrified. As we grew older, we started to rationalize and say to ourselves, well, maybe there isn't a monster under it. And we turn on the light, look in the flashlight, and convince ourselves that it's not there. And we kind of got over it. We grew up. But even as adults, sometimes we're sitting in our house, it's dark and it's late at night, and we hear a sound and we start thinking about monsters, and we get this weird, irrational relationship to monsters, and are they there and they're not there. If you think about it, at some fundamental level, that's kind of like our relationship to chemicals. You know, you can't see them, but we know that they're there. We're scared of them, but we're not really sure they're scary, you know, because maybe they are toxic, maybe they aren't, because you read the newspapers, everything's going to kill you, everything's toxic. We kind of know that that's not probably right, but we do know that some. So that relationship that we have with monsters and chemistry is not that dissimilar, and we need to somehow learn better how to shine the light and open the doors of the closets when we're talking about chemistry. So anyways, if you come to the site, you see this art exhibit, and that we Beyond Benign features these different artists all the time. And then as you walk deeper into it, all of a sudden you're in a lab and you see beakers and flasks and chemistry and everything else.
That's very cool. Well, I want to encourage my listeners in New England to check this out. Beyond Benign, BINIGN.org, will put you in touch. Will you indulge me in a couple of curveballs?
Sure.
Clean coal.
Again, so what you're going to hear from me over and over, and maybe this is a disappointment, is science and technology is incremental. And I may feel very strongly that clean coal is not clean coal and is not what it is, what we should do.
Well, it comes back to what you said about marketing.
Right.
Clean coal, to me it's an oxymoron because, mountaintop mining is not clean.
Right.
And the burning of coal is not clean.
Yep.
And so I think of it as a big corporate lie.
Yeah. And so where I come on this is to stay out of that conversation, but to say, man, if we had so many alternative technologies that were cost effective, superior in performance, and were hands and feet over better for the environment and for human toxicity, market forces would force that adoption. The problem that we have is those technologies don't exist in a performance and cost-effective way. And so I'm just a simple chemist. I can't get into the politics. I can't get into the sociology. But I can say, as a chemist, my responsibility is to get my ass in the lab and make a better technology and displace that technology and come up with a way of training the future workforce to have those skills so that we can go back again. If a chemist hasn't had a class in toxicology and environmental impact, how can we ask them to invent a safer technology for energy if they haven't had that fundamental basic training? So my little role in all of this big picture is to be focusing on the practitioners of chemistry, up their game, and start solving these problems through cost-effective, competitively viable technologies.
All right, one more, and that is I am enamored of the Tesla automobile. It's not mine, but there's one always parked right outside my office here. And I'm attracted to the idea of electric cars. You have to think about where the electricity came from before you declare yourself really green. And I like Teslas because they feature radios with the tune-in platform, and people can listen to my podcasts in their cars without all kinds of wires and additional gizmos. But the batteries in Teslas and other electric and hybrid cars give me pause.
Yep.
Should they?
Yes. The enemy of the excellent is the perfect. All right, and perfect doesn't exist, but we've got a catch-22. If there isn't a market that is going to use the better batteries, who's going to invest in making a better battery? So it's one of these chicken and egg stories that, you know, if many, many, many people were going to make a little bit of money doing something, if it already exists, people will join the bandwagon. But if it doesn't exist, there's no one that has enough vested interest to make that initial investment. If few people are going to make a ton of money. They'll lay down the investment to have it be created. So the only way we're going to create better batteries is the financial incentive for someone to make that investment. Mm-hmm. So Tesla, although it's not perfect, is providing the platform so that as people come up with better technologies, they've de-risked that investment because they already know there's a car that'll probably take it if it's invented. And so I have to look at that bigger picture and realize that I wish the world was different, you know, and I wish there was less prizes that reward people for inventing better technologies, because the problem is investing in the invention in the first place. To add money to someone who's already figured out how to get that investment kind of seems counterproductive to me.
Yeah.
But and so we need the companies that have built the pathway to commercial success so that if you build it, they will come. So if someone said, gee whiz, if we make a better battery, will someone buy it? Well, then who's going to invest in that? So, mm-hmm. you know, so we've got to realize that it's going to take years and years, if not decades, of incremental development. And so we need to have companies that take those risks so that it provides that incentive base.
Well, your ride's going to be here in a minute. I hope they have a Tesla or something exciting
to
cruise you in.
Yeah.
But John C. Warner, it's been a real pleasure to meet you, and I've enjoyed talking with you, and I learned quite a few things here. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Well, I hope you found this as interesting as I have. Send me your comments and feedback. Peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you. Until we meet again, happy trails to you. Keep smiling.